always a pleasure when we get to say hello to our good friend, Dr. Jerry Punch, as he joins us for the next hour of the show. Last two segments this hour, first two next hour. His appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville, right over in the Suburban Shopping Center, just west of Westtown Mall. Shop local. When you take a look at what they have done for, what they mean to, and how much they enjoy being a part of the community, Doc, your family, the moment you walk in the door, and what they do is the very best they can to help you be the very best you can.
Absolutely. You'll walk anywhere. I walked into the Tennessee game on Saturday, noticed a lot of folks wearing New Balance. Thank you. I'm sure that your feet thank you as well. But you go into New Balance in Knoxville, Sharon and David, and all the folks will take great care of you. You do become family, and you'll do yourself and your feet a favor by going in. You'll get a perfect size, lots of options and to choose from in terms of variety. Also clothing, dry fit. You want that dry fit to wear to the game or just to go out and tailgate, you got them there as well. I think that, and if you didn't know, John, I think people need to realize this is a store that does give back to the community in so many ways. You go to any charity events in town, you'll normally see their name pop up somewhere there as a supporter and sponsor. So why not support them? They support our show and sports, hopefully, that you enjoy. So why not support them? Go by the folks at New Balance of Knoxville, you'll be glad you did.
Boy, Doc, what were your takeaways? Because there was a lot to unpack from Bristol, wasn't there?
Holy cow, what a weekend. College football, surprises and some shocks there, which we can talk about in a minute. But Bristol, it's Bristol, baby, and it did not disappoint. The Xfinity race was like something out of a Star Wars movie. You had guys beating and banging off, sparks flying everywhere. They come across the line sideways, A.J. Allmendinger, and Cindric, you know, Austin Cindric, these guys are battling for the regular season title, and that race determined the regular season champion, which happened to be A.J. Allmendinger. And then Allmendinger, who's sliding sideways, his teammate Justin Haley can't get stopped, who's running third, and Haley T-bones him after they cross the start-finish line. So fortunately, everybody's okay, but what a wild one. And here's the best part. Those guys, Austin Cindric, who's a fine young man, going to Cup next year, they got out, they handled themselves well, obviously disappointed, frustrated, but they drove their tails off with their cars and then got out and just showed a lot of respect for their competitors, which doesn't happen sometimes in other sports. But a great event for Friday night. And Saturday night, holy cow, ended up with a discussion, you might say, between Kevin Harvick and Chase Elliott, and when the race was over, and we can get into what they were discussing or how that. But Kyle Larson gets his sixth win of the year. And so at the end of the segment one, they had to send four drivers out of the playoffs, and those four that didn't make it were Tyler Reddick, Eric Almirola, Kurt Busch, and Michael McDowell, who opened the year winning the Daytona 500. So Harvick gets in, although he is the only driver remaining in the playoffs that has not won this year. I think that will change in this next segment. But
yeah, he was going to win, it looked like, on Saturday, and then Chase Elliott decided to act like a Busch driver.
Yeah, as
opposed to a Winston Cup.
Yeah, well, and I think what Harvick tried to get out, I talked to some people who are right there. I can't use their names because they are, were in an official capacity there. So they said that Harvick was very reserved because of Chase and because of the popularity of Chase. But I said when the discussion was over, Harvick basically said, next time I will drive through him. Because Dale Earnhardt or Rusty Wallace or Jeff Gordon or Mark Martin, none of those guys would have been patient enough as I was when he pulled up in front to take my line. They would have sent him sailing. You ever heard of the bump and run? You ever heard of the Terry Labonte move? He said, you might want to pull up that video because next time that happens, he's going to see that happen over and over again in his mirror. So, I don't know. Now, in fairness to Chase Elliott, he was leading, and Kevin Harvick and he were running three wide, and Harvick got up into the side of him. It's Bristol. I saw Harvick's car slip and slide, rear front. He bangs into the left rear of Elliott. They cut a tire down. He comes in, loses three laps. So if you're supporting Chase, you could easily say, well, that costs him a chance to get to win the race, which indeed it did, but that's Bristol. That happens at Bristol. But then I don't know if you come back out three laps down and impact the winner of the race, because that can come back to haunt you. Anyway, it was a wild Bristol. Harvick finishes second. Kyle Larson gets his sixth win of the year. And now it's round two, and it all starts in Vegas. We'll see what happens there. Of course, early in the year at Las Vegas, who was the winner? Kyle Larson got his first of his six wins. So he's got to be the early favorite. Although I think that you might see something out of the Toyotas out there. Truex will be good, and so will Kyle Busch.
There, as you mentioned, not only was it what was going on the track, but also college football. How impressed were you with one? It looked like Alabama was simply going to run away from Florida in Gainesville with the 18-point lead early on, but then there was Florida with a chance to tie it with a 2-point try, and then disaster struck.
It's just hard to believe that it comes down to, if you don't think special teams are special, then that's a prime example. You got a chance. I just think Dan Mullen had an incredible game plan, and give him credit. I mean, you can like him or dislike the guy, but I tell you what, he went at halftime and said, you know, I'm going to do my game plan is going to be what my quarterback, Emory Jones, is playing, you know, in place of Anthony Richardson, the flipper, as we saw in the pregame. And I'm going to do what he does best. I'm going to go out there. And I also know that Alabama struggles with a zone read and a run pass options. If the quarterback is athletic, then their losses in the SEC have been to athletic quarterbacks. So they come out in the second half and they let Emory Jones, who had been booed by the Florida fans early in the game, which I don't get. I don't like that. You know, I agree with, you know, Tim Tebow and others who are Florida Gators and said, why do they do that? This kid, you know, he doesn't go out there and play poorly because he wants to. It just happens. But now this kid's leading the team. And he led them on five drives of 75 yards or more, including a 99-yard drive against the Alabama defense. And Jimmy, you mentioned early in the first half hour in your news and notes how many yards that they rushed for against Alabama. You know, and so that's impressive. And they have to go for two. And it was not a good, well-executed, you know, handoff. It was like no one wanted to take the ball, or both wanted to keep the football, and it was and John, as you said, Alabama tackled them both just to be sure. Yeah. What a game! And I tell you, and Florida's defense after those first few drives, in essence, Florida's defense shut down Alabama for like 2/3 of the game. They were, you know, physical up front against the run, pressure, you know, secondary. They played really, really well. So I think that, you know, after the game, if you saw Dan Mullen's press conference, I think he was as confident as I've seen him, and the players are also confident, saying we will see them again. Now, they've got a few games to play between now and when they want to see Alabama again, and they have to take care of business, but including this week against Tennessee. So we'll see. But yeah, what an impressive performance by the Gators against Alabama.
Our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch. If you have a question or comment for Doc, whether it be NASCAR, football, basketball, you name it, he's willing to talk about it all. But we go to the phones, and it is Tom who joins us first. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a great question. What is your all-time favorite Bristol night race? I'm sure you all have a special one that you remember the best.
Oh, gosh.
I know the legends of some of Earnhardt and Wallace and all the guys have got stories.
Oh, God. So many. There's so many. It's hard to, you know, I would say, you know, as far as just action, when the Earnhardt spinning, you know, Terry Labonte, you know, in the final lap when he meant to rattle his cage because the place just erupted.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm standing in victory lane, and Earnhardt, even, you know, he's pretty, you know, he was pretty, you know, he had that Clint Eastwood stare, you know, it didn't, nothing bothered him, but I think even he could hear them booing, and people, and they were already interviewing some of the other drivers on radio while they were waiting for us to do television. We were in commercial, and he could hear some of the drivers saying they were furious at Earnhardt, and he got out and cool as he could be. That would be one. I think the bump and runs with Rusty, Rusty and Jeff Gordon were pretty good. Brad Keselowski coming from dead last to win it, come all the way through the field and survive at Bristol. In the early years, Charlie Glotzback, probably before your time, Charlie Glotzback, the Kell Yarborough, some of the early Junior Johnson races, the domination by Darrell Waltrip. I mean, there's so many good races up there. I could name a lot of these drivers. And what, you know, aside from winning, what was fun for me to see is a lot of the guys who didn't have really good cars that were back in the pack that were just independent owners would hang around the garage area. Of course, you couldn't get out. There was no tunnel back then. And they'd wait for one of the lead guys to get sick or get tired or worn out and just hang around the pits waiting for one of the top car owners to say, hey, put me in that car. If he's tired, I'll finish the race. And that happened, I think, with Charlie Glotzback one time. So it happened when Dale Jarrett was first starting to drive and he got in Michael Waltrip's car. And Michael, they told him, he said, Michael's not feeling well. well. Well, when Dale got in the car, he didn't realize that Michael wasn't feeling well because they were it was messy inside the car. So, there's some great stories behind the scenes. Alan Kulwicki, my gosh. And probably the most solemn was having to be on the air the next morning after we lost Alan Kulwicki, trying to get my breath, trying to talk and not break down as we came on the air on national television with a shot of the mountains and then the holler that was going, taking the one last Polish victory lap as they were leaving. So, gosh, I mean, so many incredible memories of Bristol.
Well, thanks.
Tom, we sure do appreciate it. Let's go next to Rusty. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Rusty.
Hey, guys. Hey, Dr. Punch.
Hey, Rusty.
I was at the Bristol race the other night. I had, since the late 70s, I think I might have missed two or three Bristol races. That might be it.
Good
but
for
I
you.
Have, I've loved going up there. It's been a wonderful experience. But Saturday night, my take on it was, Chase finally stood up to one of the older drivers and said, no, I'm not taking that crap anymore. And that I was glad to see, but I wish it had been Keselowski or one of those other guys instead of Harvick.
But yeah.
I hopefully these guys will talk it out and work it out, but NASCAR needs a rivalry right now.
They do.
I mean, they really do.
Well,
what was your take on it, Doc?
Well, I remember talking with Trevor Bain when Trevor first came into the sport and was so competitive and so, but he was too nice and people picked on him because they knew that he was not going to retaliate. And I think Chase was sort of that way. And the team said, at some point you got to step up and defend yourself. And you got, no matter who it is, you got to step up and defend yourself. And I think probably that's why Harvick did what he did. He didn't come after him because he was the young kid was trying to step up and speak his mind. I think he did that to Denny Hamlin. I think at Martinsville for his first year in the sport, he went nose to nose with Denny Hamlin and said, "You wrecked me." Why? But he wasn't screaming and shouting and ugly. He said he simply kept saying, "You wrecked me. Why would you wreck me for no reason?" I think what Harvick's comment was is that, hey, I slid up into you because you were leading. We're running side by side at Bristol. It's Bristol. We go in the corner. You're trying to hold me on the bottom of the racetrack. My car isn't going to hold the bottom of the racetrack because I'm not letting off the throttle. And I slide up into you, and that's racing at Bristol. And you want to get all mad and come out and impact the win of the race. And I haven't won a race. And I think Harvick was frustrated that, he thought he was deserved a little more respect. The kid said, "I'm going to earn some respect." So both of them, in some degree, had their were right in what they were trying to do, and I think they'll talk about it. Harvick's been, he's too good in the sport, too much of a leader, not to. But I think he also sent the message, that if the kid, and somebody asked me my opinion, I talked to a couple of officials that were there, and here again, I won't mention their name, but they said, and they love Chase, and I do too. His dad and I were great friends and still are, and I saw Chase growing up. But if that were Earnhardt or Rusty Wallace behind him when he pulled up there to take the line away, they would have sent him sailing. They would have turned him on a heart. But then again, if you're Kevin Harvick, you can't take a chance anymore and allow the guys up in the tower to make a call from an official standpoint, because he needed to be in the playoffs, and he would not have been in if they put him in the back of the field.
Rusty, we always appreciate hearing from you. With Jimmy Hyams, I'm John Wilkerson. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch, 656-9900, 656-9900, star 990 is free. For AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers, toll-free 1-866-656-9900. Doc, again, brought to you by New Balance Knoxville.
Doug, NASCAR's taken a bit of an unusual step. For the first time in a long time, they're not going to be opening at the Daytona 500. They're going to start at the L.A. Memorial Coliseum. Your thoughts on that? And have they raced there before?
Nope. They've never run. They've never run any kind of race at the L.A. Coliseum. And it's interesting. They this will be the opening exhibition, the Clash. It used to be known as the Busch Clash or the Bud Shootout. It has always been run at Daytona. This will be the first time it's not run at Daytona to begin the year. So on February 6th. They will go to the L.A. Coliseum, part of the L.A. Coliseum centennial celebration. It's Ben Kennedy, the senior vice president of strategy and promotions for NASCAR, who is the grandson of Bill France Jr. He's the son of Lisa France Kennedy. So he's the one that set this up. He said, L.A. is so synonymous with major sports and entertainment events. Why not Why not do something different outside the box? And so the television network that has the first half of the year is Fox. They're located in L.A. They said, why not? We can promote it here. It'll be the first ever event for the next generation cars. Now, the question is, has NASCAR ever run in a stadium? And the answer is certainly. They certainly have a few times. And they ran at Bowman Gray Stadium from 1950 to 1971 on a quarter-mile racetrack around. And that track still runs today. It's called the Madhouse, where they run the modifieds. It is the home on Saturdays to the Winston-Salem State Rams, who play college football in that stadium. And on weekends, it's a racetrack. They've also ran, and get this, I bet people didn't realize that auto racing ran regularly at Soldier Field in Chicago long before the Chicago Bears made it their home. The Bears moved there from Wrigley Field in 1971. Auto racing ran there in the 50s. I think Fred Lorenzen, Tom Pistone won races. Fireball Roberts won a 100-lapper there. And also, for those of you in this area, some of the people that some of our older race fans may remember, that on July 12, 1958, in Asheville, North Carolina, at a baseball stadium, inside a baseball stadium, NASCAR ran an event, and Lee Petty, Richard Petty's dad, during practice got his car stuck headfirst into the dugout and had to be pulled out of the dugout, so he had to go in for a reliever of a car. He ended up running well. Jim Pascal, Cotton Owens, and Rex Wyatt were the top three. So, yes, they have run stadiums in the past, but this will be the first time they've ever opened the season in the modern era inside the L.A. Coliseum on a quarter-mile racetrack.
Let's go to the phones. It's Jim who joins us next. Excuse me. Let's go to Jim. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Dr. Punch. You know, when I first heard that college football was going to go to instant replay, I was just very, very happy about that because I had always, you know, longed for the day where we'd be able to correct some bad calls that, you know, might change the course of outcomes. But I never expected an absolutely perfect system because there are still human beings involved. But, you know, we have a guy up in the booth looking at all the plays and going to, you know, take a better look if he wants to stop it. We have collaborative replay in some leagues, not all of them. We've got coaches with challenges on certain plays, and yet we still have what happened in the Memphis Mississippi State game. I saw the play, but I don't know the particulars of what the mess up was. Where was the screw up on this? How did this happen? So I'd like to get you in. Listen, I still want instant replay with its warts and all. So I'm not ready to throw it out, but I'm trying to figure out what went wrong in this debacle, and are there any other things we can add to instant replay, the system, so that this kind of thing just does not happen?
Well, I tell you what the screw-up was. Basically, there was an official that went in waving his arms like the play is dead. And so they refer to that as an inadvertent whistle-type situation. The play should have been dead, and so Memphis should have gotten the ball on roughly the 6-yard line instead of returning a punt 94 yards. So that was a major screw-up. You could argue that the second Mississippi State guy actually put his hand on the ball to down it. And not very long, but anyway, the mix-up was the official that waved his hands to say the play is over, and then the play continued. And when you wave your hands like that, obviously Mississippi State players could have seen it and stopped, but they didn't. And the replay official should have interjected and come back and said, hey, Memphis is ball on the six.
And there were two players of the same number, two number fours on the field, which is an automatic 5-yard penalty and replay or whatever. So, and that's been called numerous times. I think most recently at North Carolina, was at Louisville a year mm-hmm. ago, they had two number 22s on the field. So that's a 5-yard penalty. So not only did they miss the fact that they should have stopped it and replayed it, and it shouldn't have counted because of an inadvertent whistle or a hand wave, but that should have been a penalty against Memphis for two two players, number four on the field. Yeah. So it was a double a miss. Yeah.
And Tennessee had two players wearing number one on a punt return, and that was missed against Tennessee Tech.
Yeah.
Where does the coaches' challenges come in? Because I'm always confused on this, how many they get or what they can challenge or can't challenge. Would a challenge have been appropriate in that Mississippi State game?
I think you have to have a timeout to have a challenge, and I don't know the answer to that. But, yes, you could have challenged, just like Heupel could have challenged a spot with 6 minutes left against Pitt, but he elected not to because he only had one timeout left. So, yes, that could have been a challenge there. And I don't know if there was an attempt to have a challenge, and I don't know if there were timeouts remaining. So I don't know the answer to that, Jim.
Well, like I said, I still want instant replay with it. It's not perfect. But, boy, I just hate to see something like that happen when a team seemingly gets robbed on a touchdown. Does Tennessee have a chance Saturday, guys? I know not Friday. How about Saturday? We got a chance?
Next question?
Yep. There's always a chance.
But you know what? You know, here's the thing is Florida, they left it all on the field against Alabama. Those kids played their hearts out. And when the game was over, all the media were saying, you're going to see those guys again. And all those players are saying, yeah, we are. And if they start looking beyond anybody in the SEC, anything can happen. And, you know, I just think it's Tennessee's going to have to play really, really well, not turn the ball over. And you've got to be able to move the football. You can't, with that offense, if you leave your defense on the field, you know, for long drives and you come back out with this quick huddle attack, up-tempo attack, you're going to have your defense worn out, you know, before the middle of the second quarter. So you're going to have to get some breaks, get some turnovers. And who'd have thought that UT Chattanooga was going to be leading Kentucky in the fourth quarter? I mean, but yeah, that happens.
Yeah. Kentucky was fortunate to get out of there with a win.
Jim, if I were to break it down, I'd say contain the run, win the turnover battle, and connect on some of those passes in the passing game.
Well, I'll tell you what, I wish we could hit a few long ones. We're trying, but can't make the connection, you know.
Yep.
Guys, good to talk to you. Have a good afternoon.
Jim, sure to appreciate our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch. His final segment with us, his appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville. Let's say hello to Tony, who joins us. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Tony.
Hi, good afternoon. Hope you guys are doing well.
Yes, sir.
My question is a ruling on the Memphis and Mississippi State game. I don't think it was the one that the previous caller was talking about. Mississippi State kicked the ball, and they was going to down it inside the 5-yard line, and two of their players touched the ball, but they never took possession of it. The punt receiver noticed it. He grabs it and takes off a touchdown. I thought the ball was dead when they touched the ball, and then they said the ruling actually says if the boy tried to pick it up and messed it up, then he's not considered as a fumble, then it would be a dead ball. And I didn't know if y'all could clarify that for me, or did you see the play or whatever?
I did. Here's the rule on a punt like that. If you are tapping the ball, if you're the punting team and you're tapping the ball, it is a live ball for the return team until you stop the ball, until you down the ball, until you put your hand on the ball when it's on the ground or you catch the ball. And then they cannot advance it. But if you touch it and it's still rolling around, the punt return team can pick it up and take off. And if that punt return team takes off running it and fumbles it and loses a fumble, they can take the ball back where they picked it up. It's not a
Has it always been that way, or they changed it lately?
I can't speak to always, but it's been that way ever since I started following football.
I thought that was wild. Anyway, guys, I appreciate your show and enjoy to listen to you, and I'll let you go.
Okay.
Tony, thank you. Let's go next to Paul. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Fine. How are you?
Doing fine. Hey, I just got a question about what y'all's opinion is on Major League Baseball, where they moved the All-Star game out of Atlanta, and then all of a sudden now they're moving their baseball operations, which is Rawlings, over to China to make their equipment, and taking out of Minnesota and moving it over to China. I just wondered what y'all's opinion was, if that's a good thing for baseball or a bad thing.
Well, first of all, these things are night and day in terms of the situations. Major League Baseball felt it necessary. I didn't think it was to move the All-Star game out of Atlanta after we saw some things that were passed in Georgia that apparently they didn't agree with. So I thought that was a bad move. And then I also think they're not moving baseball operations, and Major League Baseball is not doing this. They have a 20% stake in this factory that Rawlings has operated. Rawlings is the one that's moving its helmet making of that operation to Missouri, and it's the bat making that's going to China. And they said that roughly 10% of those jobs would be what winds up in China, with the others being relocated to Missouri. So that's not an MLB thing. They are indeed an owner, and there's a lot of encouragement from several parties that are hoping that Rawlings will reconsider its decision to do this, because this is supposed to be phased in a span of about 18 to 24 months.
Right, right. You don't think Major League Baseball could put a little, well, since they own some of Rawlings equipment manufacturing, to put a little pressure on them to stay?
Well, I mean, Rawlings has 80% of the holdings there. Major League Baseball has 20. I mean, sure, they could strongly encourage them. But yeah, it's certainly bad optics, I think. What do you think, Doc?
Yeah, I think it looks bad, and you know, I realize you want to move some things around. I wish they'd had better options than to move it to move some of that to China, and leave it in the U.S. You know, there's a lot of Major League bats are made by a current LSU trainer, Jack Marucci, you know, lives in Louisiana, and he's got his own bat-making company. I see a lot of his bats are now being used by major leagues. I often wondered if that's where the term bat on rouge came from. But they make a lot of bats down there.
All right. Thank y'all.
All right, Paul, thank you. What do you think, Jimmy?
I'm completely opposed to it, and I know this is not going to sound right, but until the human rights issues in China can be corrected, I don't want anything over there. I think their record on that is despicable, and I think it's a bad move, and I dislike it.
Yeah, and I think human rights is only the tip of the iceberg with moving something like that to China. I absolutely agree.
Well, Doc, also, as far as we were talking about some of the races that are advancing, you said in Las Vegas you like Kyle Larson. Who are some others that you think will do well in Vegas?
I think Logano, Keselowski will do well. I think Martin Truex Jr. Out of the Joe Gibbs stable will be hard to handle there in Vegas. You know, and I think Chase Elliott will bounce back. You know, I think in this round two, you got Las Vegas this week, and you got Talladega, which is anybody's race. Brad Keselowski won at Talladega back in the spring. And then the last part of this round two segment, round of 12, is the Roval in Charlotte. You got to love Chase Elliott there, because Chase Elliott's wins this year have come at Circuit of the Americas in Austin and Road America. So he's a road racing guy. So I think that I would look at Larson's got to be the favorite. I think Truex could be right there with him. Logano would be a sneaky pick, and then Chase Elliott at Las Vegas. Talladega, it's anybody's guess. You know, it would not surprise me to see a surprise winner at Talladega, someone like a Stenhouse, but also Brad Keselowski and Logano are really good there, and in the Roval, Chase Elliott. But, you know, I mentioned a little bit about the new schedule coming out for NASCAR, mm-hmm. and there were some changes for next year, you know, as far as what they're going to do. They are going to run a race, a cup race, for the first time at Worldwide Technology Raceway. They used to be called Gateway in St. Louis. It's actually in Madison, Illinois, right across the bridge from St. Louis. So they're going to go there on June 5th. They took one of the two races that was a doubleheader at Pocono away. NASCAR is only going to run three Saturday night races as opposed to having run four this year. They feel like the ratings aren't generated on Saturday nights like they are on Sundays, which I applaud, because for many, many years, people would come home from church and settle down, have lunch, and then turn the race on Sundays. That's when our ratings were through the roof for many, many years in NASCAR. Remember, this year they experimented with some midweek races in prime time because of some of the issues that COVID presented on scheduling. They are going to move the Bristol Dirt Race will be running in prime time. And I think in next year's playoffs are going to be rearranged a little bit. They're going to go Darlington, Kansas, Bristol in round one Then Texas, Talladega, Charlotte in round two. Las Vegas, Homestead is back and Martinsville in round three, and they'll finish it up at Phoenix. So the schedule, again, this year, if people didn't hear, they are going to run the Clash, the exhibition race on February 6th at L.A. Coliseum, and that will be as part of the L.A. Coliseum Centennial. And then they will be in Daytona to begin the season in earnest on February 20th with the Daytona 500.
Two Tennessee football questions for you. Number one, how concerning is it that Tennessee did not dominate the line of scrimmage against Tennessee Tech?
Yeah, very concerning to me. The fact that you couldn't get much push up front offensively when you sometimes are 50, 60, 70 pounds a man, weight advantage and strength and size advantage, couldn't get much push, couldn't run the ball effectively, also didn't dominate the line of scrimmage defensively, played well overall. But the fact that they could run, that the Tennessee Tech starting quarterback could run the ball and had lots of open air field to run, that doesn't bode well when you got those two Florida quarterbacks that can eat up some yardage out there that can run it.
That was my next question, because if you're having trouble with Tennessee Tech quarterback, what about Emory Jones and Anthony Richardson?
Yeah, exactly. You know, those guys can run it, and the zone reads from running down the field, that's going to be, you know, and I think Tennessee, we see Tennessee's challenge. Tennessee's played well up front. I think they played above what expectations were. I think some of the Achilles' heel is going to be the fact that they're not as strong and deep at linebacker, and I think that's what Tennessee Tech saw, and they was able to use the quarterback draw and some of the quarterback runs to get some yardage, and I think Florida will do the same.
Still tough to believe that Florida State's 0-3 for the first time since the bicentennial.
How about that? 1976, the last time the Seminoles started 0-3. And it's so frustrating, you know, Mike Norvell, is 3-9 as the Seminoles head coach. He's 3-9. They go to Wake Forest, and I've done Wake Forest Florida State games back when Bobby Bowden was at Florida State, and Wake's always given them a fit and had nearly beaten them a couple of times when they were ranked in the top five of the country. But you can't beat anybody when you turn it over six times. Florida State turned the ball over six times. How about Dave Clawson and what they're doing, you know, at Wake Forest with the Demon Deacons? He loses a running back who transfers to Michigan State, and he's now a bell cow up there for them, so they're playing well. But yeah, Florida State, you know, 0-3 on the season after playing so well in the opener against Notre Dame.
Yeah, very much so. Doc, we always appreciate it. Hope you have a fantastic week, and we look forward to catching up with you next Monday.
We'll talk to you next Monday, guys. Thanks a lot.
That's Dr. Jerry Punch. His appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville. Shop local. Shop New Balance Knoxville right there in the suburban shopping center just west of West Town Mall.